You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 8th of April 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, I've got some good news to begin with today. Boris Johnson's fever appears to be going down. Hopefully, we're starting to see some improvement here. There have been lots of horrible tweets sent out by people on the left, wishing harm upon him. There was one tweet that was actually sent out yesterday by an Asian doctor, I believe. And they said, I bet Boris is wishing he was being treated by white men that went to the same university as him. And this tweet was supposed to imply that Boris was some kind of a racist. But in actual fact, if he was sensible, then yes, he would most certainly be wishing that he was being treated by white men, especially after the example that we have seen of Dr. Tedros leading the World Health Organization. And we also hear that Donald Trump is going to withdraw funding for the World Health Organization after his incompetence. But will anybody speak up and say, well, that is only to be expected because of where he comes from? I doubt it. But that's the truth of the matter. We've also got another news story, another brief news story here that follows on from the one we were talking about earlier in the week about this jihadi in France that went on a stabbing rampage. We've had another Muslim go on a rampage, exactly as I predicted. Police shot and killed a Muslim truck driver in Knoxville Tuesday after the man stabbed four women at a truck stop, killing three of them and hospitalizing one. Idris Abdus Salam was the man responsible for the stabbings, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation says. And of course, they have said we don't know what the motive was for that, and there's not really that much information that's forthcoming about that. But the main news really over here in Britain yesterday was David Icke being banned from YouTube for one of his videos. And this came up in the afternoon. There was a BBC news report on it. It was just staggering to see the BBC so proud of getting their competition banned from YouTube. And by doing this, all they really do is draw attention to David Icke, and they draw attention to his conspiracy theories. The number one trending hashtag on Twitter yesterday was David Icke. Thousands of people, more people, maybe even millions of more people, will now watch his video because they've been told that it was banned, because it was censored. I mean, I don't agree with a lot of David Icke's conspiracy theories. I think they're way over the top. He's a bit of a crazy, but he's completely harmless. And the people that follow him are completely harmless. Just because a tiny minority have gone and attacked masts that they believe to be 5G, you can't lay that at the feet of David Icke. You can't say, oh, because David Icke is saying this is why these people are doing this. The people that are doing things like that are breaking the law. They're lawbreakers, basically. It's not like David Icke has hypnotized them and he's controlling them. They are responsible for their own actions. When you've got somebody that's putting out an alternative view, the way to answer that, if you believe them to be wrong, is to put out your view and make sure that it's backed up by the facts. And quite clearly, if people are believing what David Icke is saying about this, about 5G and coronavirus, then there must be some evidence for what he is saying. So the answer to that is to put out counter evidence that is more believable. And by banning it, it's effectively saying that they don't have any counter evidence. I mean, this is quite a shocking increase in censorship when you think about it. I mean, let's just have a look at this article first, actually, a brief bit from it. This is what the BBC had to say about it. The interview was watched by about 65,000 people as it was streamed, some of whom clicked on an on-screen button to trigger payments to make their live chat reactions stand out. 65,000 people were watching this. So they are basically the competition for the BBC. If 65,000 people were watching it when it was being streamed, then you can make a safe bet probably over a million people will be watching the video after it's been streamed. And nobody's saying that, nobody's pointing out that these mainstream media monopolies are using the weight of their monopoly power to suffocate the competition, because David Icke is part of the alternative media. The BBC should not be allowed to just get rid of its competition like this. The BBC say YouTube only deleted the content after the session had ended, despite being aware of the broadcast while it was ongoing. But it changed its rules after the BBC questioned why the video was permitted. So obviously the video wasn't actually breaking any of the YouTube guidelines. And YouTube said, "We have now made any content that disputes the existence or transmission of COVID-19 as described by the World Health Organization and local health authorities in violation of YouTube policies. This includes conspiracy theories which claim that the symptoms are caused by 5G. So YouTube have now changed their guidelines because the BBC have told them to, basically. And what about these World Health Organization evidence? The World Health Organization told us that it couldn't be transmitted from human to human. The World Health Organization told us that it wasn't such a risk if we kept our borders open with China. So they're saying anybody that contradicts what the World Health Organization is saying is going to be banned from YouTube. I mean, what the excuse that the BBC are using, they're saying that people that are listening to this are and believing David Icke, they're not obeying the social distancing guidelines, which is dangerous. Well, the social distancing guidelines are enforced by law. So if people are going to ignore these guidelines, then they're breaking the law and they're going to get fined and they could end up in prison. And I think you can draw an analogy here with drugs. Drugs are against the law. If you're caught in possession of them or supplying them, then you're breaking the law and you can be arrested. But that doesn't mean that all information that is alternative information to the information the government puts out about drugs is banned. You have to rely on people to make up their own minds about whether something is believable or not. And this is supposed to be a democracy. We are supposed to be able to hear everybody's voice, and we're supposed to be able to make our own minds up about whether we believe them or not. That's the whole point of having a democracy. And we've gone from silencing people that criticize government policy as far as immigration is concerned to now silencing people that present alternative viewpoints on medical issues. And it's not just YouTube that have done this. WhatsApp have done the same. YouTube's rules update coincides with new restrictions on WhatsApp. Facebook's app is limiting users to only being able to forward a message to one chat at a time if the same post has already been shared 5 or more times by the wider community. Such posts are labeled with double arrows to make their status known. Previously, the app had limited such messages to being forwarded to 5 different chats at once, a limit it had first introduced in 2018 to combat the spread of disinformation in India. So how are they defining disinformation here? How are they defining fake news here? Well, they're defining it by it being popular. So the most popular posts, the posts that people have democratically decided are the ones that they want to see the most of, they're now being banned from seeing them. So again, this is removing democracy from the internet. It's saying that you're not allowed to see the most popular content. The content that people want to share, we're just going to ban that. And this is an admission, isn't it, that we don't live in a democracy. And The Sun have actually taken a poll. That's the UK newspaper, The Sun. They've taken a poll entitled, "Do you think YouTube should have removed David Icke's videos?" Yes, 15%. No, 80%. Undecided, 3%. So the democracy disagrees with YouTube removing David Icke's videos. I think most sensible people will disagree with that. And as I say, the end result of that it has been to see David Icke as the number one trending hashtag, and potentially millions of people will now watch that video and think that there is some credibility to it, because the BBC were so frightened of people seeing it that they got it banned. Instead of just responding to it by listing the points that David Icke made and then presenting alternative information. That's how you deal with these things. It's ridiculous. Also looking at coronavirus news here, RT appear to have found rather a strange correlation. Countries with TB vaccine programs actually have 10 times fewer cases. And of course, this is only a correlation. It doesn't mean that if you have a TB vaccine program, then you're not likely to get coronavirus. It could be something else. But it's the same thing with what David Icke has found. And he's found that there is a correlation between places that have 5G and increases in coronavirus. That doesn't mean that 5G has caused the coronavirus. It just means that there's a correlation there. It could be caused by all manner of things. It could just be coincidence. It's not saying that it's caused by it. It's just saying that there's a correlation there. And that's all people would need to point out as far as what David Icke is saying. It's a correlation. Obviously, this needs more investigation. Brussels have just banned 5G from being put in Brussels. So there obviously are health concerns about this. BBC are going about this all the wrong way. And the fact that they were bragging about it, boasting about it, is absolutely sickening, that they were boasting about basically being the bully on the beach that kicks down the children's sandcastle. And that's what they've done by banning him. Perhaps that's a better analogy for the smaller content creators that put a lot of work into having their voice heard, making their videos, and YouTube just bans them on the say-so of people like the BBC and Hope Not Hate, and they're just playground bullies, basically. That's all it is, playground bullies, destroying the fun of the smaller creators and destroying their work. Also, on an issue that I spoke about yesterday, about the fact that blood transfusions might be a solution to this, because the hemoglobin appears to be damaged in these people that are in the intensive care units. And because the hemoglobin is damaged, it can't carry the oxygen around. And the way that the intensive care units are dealing with this is to pump loads of air into the body, pump loads of oxygen into the body. But if the hemoglobin is not able to transport that oxygen around, then it's not going to be any help. I mean, what this doctor was suggesting yesterday is that they need to have blood transfusion as well as be put on the ventilator. Well, now the Daily Star are talking about something similar. A coronavirus treatment that has already been approved in the UK has helped patients recover within 3 days. Convalescent plasma therapy involves giving people a dose of blood donated by COVID-19 survivors, which contains the antibodies their immune system needs to fight off the virus. The technique was first introduced a century ago during the Spanish flu pandemic and has already been used in China, Italy, and the US. And remember, this has already been okayed by the UK, which is very good because apparently one of the chief doctors has said that the doctors over here can't use chloroquine. They've just got to use oxygen and paracetamol. Dr. Mike Ryan, head of the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Program, has labeled the potentially life-saving treatment a very important area to pursue. There's still not enough evidence to say if it will be effective on large populations, but a test in Wuhan has proved a positive sign. A pilot study saw 10 severely ill patients who had been given plasma therapy have their symptoms vanish or vastly improve less than 72 hours later. The patient's liver and lung function, as well as blood oxygen levels, improved, signs that they had successfully fought off the virus. So that's great. And this is plasma treatment, but what some of these doctors have been saying, the one that I was reporting on yesterday, they're saying that it's not just plasma that people need, it's actually full blood transfusions that they need. And of course, there might be a problem with that, with the providing of the blood, because as we know, blacks and minority ethnics don't like giving blood. White people give lots of blood, but of course you can't use most white people's blood in black people. What a lot of people don't realize is that the racial groups also have different blood types in the majority, most of them. Not all of them, but most of them, most of the people in a racial group have a different blood type to those from other racial groups, which is why there's a big drive in the NHS to get black people to donate blood. So we could see a problem with this, because it does look as if there are more black and minority ethnics actually getting this disease than there are white people. That's been confirmed in America. It's actually twice the number of blacks are actually getting this disease than their percentage of the population. This was reported on RT. And amazingly, they are still claiming that this is caused by racism. Of course, it's not caused by racism. It's caused by them ignoring the social distancing guidelines. As we have also reported on, we have had Muslims meeting up for mosque at the weekend. There were 100 Muslims that turned up for a Muslim funeral and a Labour MP alongside them. We've also heard about how in France, they're ignoring the quarantine and the police are unable to start arresting them for fear of starting off a riot and upsetting community cohesion. So the reason why more of these blacks are getting this disease is because they're ignoring these guidelines. But of course they're saying, oh no, it's down to racism. It's because they haven't got big enough houses, because they haven't got enough money to afford healthcare. I mean, it's absolutely shocking that people are actually being charged in America to be treated for coronavirus. And another aspect of this that I noticed yesterday, as I was watching the news, it seemed that all the patients and all the recovered patients that they were showing on there were all non-white. And I thought, well, is it only non-whites that are getting this? Clearly not, because there have been a few white people dotted around that have got it. And I thought, well, maybe what they're using here is the carrot and the stick. And non-whites are being given the carrot. They are being shown lots of non-white people that are getting ill with coronavirus in the news and on the television. And white people are being given the stick. They're being chased for walking the dog in the countryside. They've got drones going after them. They're being fined. So they're basically being punished. White people are being punished and not shown white victims on the TV, and brown people are being encouraged to socially distance by seeing that there are actually a lot of brown patients on the TV. It's interesting that we're not actually seeing so many white people that are ill on there. It's just a thought that crossed my mind yesterday, and then of course I hear today that so many more blacks in America are actually getting this disease. Also in America, we've had another confirmation of what I was talking about, not actually on the Daily Nationalist, but on Arian Britannia this week. Right at the beginning, I did a bit of conspiracy busting And one of those points that I brought up was the fact that you would expect to see empty hospitals at the moment, because all the routine operations, all the routine surgery has been stopped. If you do have COVID patients in there, they're just going to be in the intensive care bit, the critical care bit, and they're going to be separated from the rest of the hospital. And the third point is that people are not going to want to be going to the hospital at the moment because of the risk of catching COVID-19. And actually, the New York Times is now also asking about these empty hospitals. This is a quote from it. The hospitals are eerily quiet, except for COVID-19. I have heard this sentiment from fellow doctors across the United States and in many other countries. We are all asking, where are all the patients with heart attacks and strokes? They are missing from our hospitals. Yale New Haven Hospital, where I work, has almost 300 people stricken with COVID-19, and the numbers keep rising. And yet we are not yet at capacity because of a marked decline in our usual types of patients. In more normal times, we never have so many empty beds. And of course, a lot of alternative researchers have been pointing this out. They've been saying, what's going on here? We've got so many empty hospitals. And again, YouTube have been removing their videos. And yet now here we have the New York Times that are also asking about this. And they've got a good point. What's happened to the heart attacks and the strokes? I mean, maybe it is that while people are at home, they are less likely to be doing any of the strenuous activity that might actually bring on a heart attack or a stroke. But we have to look at these alternative reports. We have to look at what's being said about this, because we can't 100% trust the media, but we can look at things like this and say, well, logically, yes, they are going to be empty. So it's just interesting that the New York Times is now asking the same sort of questions that the alternative researchers have been asking for the last month, really. Well, I've also got some interesting news here that actually comes from Bulgaria, some positive news about white history. And this was actually translated for us by Okuma from the chat room, who you may remember did some narrations for us under the name of Pelasgian. And this is a report that he has found from a Professor Boyajiev, and it concerns the earliest white settlements in Europe, because remember, we're told that the Fertile Crescent was the first area that actually had civilization in it. And of course, there's a lot of evidence to show that it was white people in the Fertile Crescent. And I've always thought that we came down from the Caucasus, and we went into the Fertile Crescent, and we also spread east, and we also spread west. But according to this professor, we may have actually come from more like the area of where Bulgaria is, and then made our way to the Fertile Crescent. This is what he says. We suspect that this could be the oldest city in Europe, explains Professor Boyajiev, and adds that the dating of the oldest finds in the mound are from the 5th millennium BC. The city spanned in a territory around 0.12 to 0.15 kilometers. What is interesting is that in the lands between the rivers of Tigris and Euphrates, villages of that size appear only 1,500 years later. 1,500 years later. And according to researchers who worked in Mesopotamian villages with surface area of 0.07 to 0.8 kilometers, those are already considered as cities. He adds, therefore, even by the standards of Mesopotamia, we can now claim that we have the beginning of some kind of a city. Also, we see the same city structure that later will be the basis of city planning. In other words, we have a large village, and on its highest point, we have some kind of a fortification or citadel. And this is the building block that every ancient city is built upon. The existence of a fortified part inside of the city, which serves as a shelter for the population in case of need. This is where the elites live. This is where we find the crafts, etc. So in Unit City, We have all the evidence we need for an advanced culture long before the earliest known cities. It is a remarkable historical monument in which life, with few interruptions, continued from the 5th millennium BC all the way up to the Middle Ages. We are talking about 6,000 years. And that's taken from V. Nikolova's About the Village Mound, Yunnat City, and the Oldest European Civilization. So that's a bit of fascinating news there, that the Europeans actually had the equivalent of these Mesopotamian cities, but 1,500 years earlier. There's also evidence for copper mines around there from much earlier as well. And I think it's in the establishment's best interest to keep the idea going that civilization began in the Fertile Crescent, because of course the Fertile Crescent is now full of Arabs, so they can claim that Mesopotamia and the Fertile Crescent, first off, it was these Arabs that actually created the cities there. And of course it wasn't the Arabs that built the cities there. The Arabs weren't Arabs at that time. If we look at the etymology of the word Arab, it comes from a Hebrew word, which is Ereb, and it actually means mongrel race, if you look the word up in the Bible Concordance. And its etymology comes from to darken. It has links with the word for twilight, evening, when the sky darkens, basically. So it's basically linked to saying that this is a people whose skin darkened and they were of mixed race. So if they were saying that at around about 2000 BC, then it can't have been these people that actually built these cities in 3500 BC. They would have still been white at the time when they were building these cities. So interesting bit of information there that contradicts the mainstream narrative about where civilization actually began. And just to finish up with here, somebody's actually dug up a PubMed article on the statistics for violence between interracial couples. Now, of course, we've always said that if you're in an interracial relationship, you stand at a much higher chance of being the victim of violence than if you were in a monoracial relationship. And there's actually a study that shows that you're much more likely to actually be killed by your partner if you're in an interracial relationship. But this was published in December 2009. And they say the number of interracial couples in the United States is growing, but they often receive little support. Although previous studies have explored the relationship between low social support and decreased relationship satisfaction in interracial couples, there are few studies on intimate partner violence in these couples. So obviously what they're trying to do there is they're trying to say, oh, it's because they haven't got very much money. But I suspect that you'll find this is the same. It doesn't matter what country you go to. It's more to do with race than how much money these people have. To better understand intimate partner violence in interracial couples compared to monoracial couples, all police-reported IPV events across a municipality were examined. Odds ratios showed differences between interracial and ethnic minority monoracial couples. Interracial couples were more likely to have history of prior intimate partner violence, 2.6 times more likely. They were found to be more likely to engage in mutual assault, 2.36 times more likely, and to result in perpetrator arrest, 1.71 times more likely than ethnic minority monoracial couples. Victims of intimate personal violence in interracial couples were also more likely to be injured, 1.37 times more likely. There were no significant differences between the couples in terms of substance abuse or children present during the violent event. Differences between intimate partner violence in interracial and white couples also emerged. Interracial couples were more likely to have children present, 1.84 times more likely. They were more likely to have a prior report of violence, 1.98 times more likely. More likely to result in victim injury, 1.73 times more likely. And more likely to result in the perpetrator being arrested than with white couples, 2.18 times more likely. Interracial couples were more likely to engage in mutual assault than white couples, 2.94 times more likely. So almost three times more likely to beat one another up. However, interracial couples were about 50% less likely than white couples to use drugs and alcohol before or during the violent event. So what that is telling us is that the interracial couples, they're not doing this because they're drugged up. They're not doing this because they're on alcohol. It's there must have been something else to cause them to become violent. Finally, they say research is needed to better understand the unique challenges and needs faced by interracial couples to help them sustain healthy partnerships. I would suggest the best way to sustain a healthy partnership is to go with somebody of your own kind. Exactly as it says in the Bible, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. If you partner up with somebody of a different race, you're going to have different ways of looking at things. You're starting off there not being equal from the start. And as we see here, that results in a much higher risk of violence resulting. The best way to keep yourself safe in an intimate relationship is to go with someone of your own kind. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.